Dr. Andrea Clavico McCormick is a Massey University chemical ecologist. She's interested in how plants use chemicals to attract pollinators, but also in how plants use chemicals to communicate to the herbivores that eat them and to other plants. Some of her work in the Tongariro National Park suggests that invasive weeds such as heather and broom are disrupting communication by native plants. She's recently been awarded Fast Start funding by the Royal Society Te Aparangi's Marsden Fund for a project looking at how plant communication is changing in times of environmental change. Dr. Clavico McCormick told me about what we know about plant-insect communication.
I think we have. So I think it's flower smell, and we all love the scents of flowers. But the reason why those scents exist in the first place is to attract pollinators. And I think that's what most people intuitively will understand about plant-insect communication.
That's
right?
Kind of an obvious one, isn't
the
it? Because we can smell it.
Indeed, exactly. But for the insects and many other insects, those plant scents, not only flower, but root volatiles, we call them volatiles, by the way, so leaf volatiles or root volatiles and are also signals to send messages to other insects. Sometimes insects will choose their preferred host plant based on their scent. Pollinators, we've already mentioned. But scents are utilized in a way that I think it's magnificent. Plants do use volatiles to attract bodyguards to them.
How does that work?
Well, when plants are attacked by herbivores, they change their scent. That may not be very well known for most people, but they completely change their smell.
In response to the attack.
Yeah, in response to the attack. And that is equivalent to screaming. They're screaming for help. So those scents that they release are
screaming.
We
don't want to be too anthropomorphic here, right?
No, that's true.
But I'll take that. Screaming for help.
It's equivalent.
Yeah.
And then those scents will attract enemies of their herbivores. So either parasitoids or predators that will attack the herbivores that are feeding on the plant. Since plants cannot shake off the herbivores or move away, they defend themselves by attracting other organisms to defend them.
If this happens a lot, then wouldn't the herbivores learn not to attack that plant?
Well, it's an arms race. That's the reality, right? So it evolves over time. And I guess that some herbivores obviously get adapted and they find ways to trick the plant. For example, some very specialized herbivores can inhibit or prevent the plant from releasing those scents so that they don't attract those other predators that are going to feed on them. But the reality is that in nature, many insects are generalists, so they don't feed only on one type of plant. And that maintains that level of diversity and that chemical communication very lively and constant and prevents one species from adapting to it quite a lot.
This is a very complicated system they've got going. How do you study that?
Well, there's many ways to study it. And one thing
and you couldn't do it in the lab, right? Or can you?
You do some things in the lab, but a lot of things you do in the field. I guess that's where it matters the most. The lovely thing about investigating plant communication is that it's very multidisciplinary. So it involves a lot of chemistry. You need to understand the chemistry of the plant. And for example, you can collect volatiles, and the way to collect it is a little bit, unconventional. We just wrap plants in cooking bags, the ones you use for turkey in the oven. Then we put filters inside of those bags. And that's how we can sort of capture the scents of the plants, and then we just can analyze them in the lab. But that's only a part of it, because you also need to do a lot of assays or experiments to find out whether those scents attract herbivores or parasitoids. And then we can do that in the field or in the lab. We have very interesting devices such as wind tunnels, where you can just put a plant in one or a scent in one and let air flow through and observe the animal's behavior towards it.
So how many volatiles are there that you know of?
Plenty.
Yeah.
Plenty. So a plant bouquet is normally a mixture of compounds and can be as many as 80 or 100. Many, many of them.
And is it possible to analyze a volatile mixture and identify the plant it comes from? Are they that specific?
Yes, that's true. So volatiles are in a way like fingerprints to a plant species. So plants of a particular species will have a particular odor blends. So in a way, it's like a fingerprint, but also the amount of those compounds may change or fluctuate depending on the environment or if they are attacked or not. So the plants are quite adaptable. And one of the things that's very flexible about this is their scent. The scent is because they communicate through it, basically, those signals also change in response to environmental factors.
So what have you discovered in terms of plant-plant communication?
Yes.
Do we call it communication plant-to-plant?
We do call it communication.
And we're familiar with the idea of, these days, underground communication.
That's correct.
Through the fungi and the root system. Have you studied that or you're above the ground?
I do mostly research of above ground volatiles, but that's, again, the only half of the story. As you well mentioned, lots of the communication is going to happen underground as well, through those mycorrhizal networks, the plant Facebook social systems.
Yeah.
Mostly I'm doing above ground communication, and I use scents a lot. I've been doing some research, very interesting research, in the Tongariro Natural Park along the desert road. And what we found, we are investigating invasive plants. And one thing that we have noticed is that when there's lots of invasives, native plants go quiet. Quiet meaning they just smell less. They reduce their emission of those volatile compounds.
Why?
We don't know exactly. And that's what we're aiming to find out. So we've been...
So some introduced plants inhibit native plants from expressing themselves.
That's exactly what we're afraid of. And if you think of, think basically pollinators. Manuka is a plant that everyone's quite familiar with, but it requires pollinators. And if these invasive plants are preventing it from releasing those scents, probably the reproduction of the plant in the long term is going to be compromised.
Mm.
So that it has many severe ecological consequences.
Can you think of any reasons why that would happen?
Yeah, so we have some hypotheses about why that could be. In the first place, as we already mentioned, there's a lot of underground communication. And underground, those plants are competing for nutrients and for lots of things. So probably there is that level of competition where the invasive are depleting the nutrients.
Right, because a new plant would interrupt the balanced ecosystem.
Correct.
And possibly take nutrients that hitherto had been available.
Exactly. So I think it challenges the native plants in finding themselves short of resources and maybe having to allocate those resources to other primary functions rather than to communication. So that could be one reason why. The other thing that's quite interesting is that plants use a lot of volatiles for kin communication. They can recognize kin and communicate with kin, so plants of the same species.
What are they saying?
Well, apparently, what has been shown is that parents recognize kin, so plants that are their siblings or their parents or their... And apparently, they actually even share nutrients and resources and reduce the chemicals that are nasty to avoid competition. So actually, they cooperate a lot. And actually, one way of cooperating is also through scents, right? Because if you are a flowering plant and release lots of scents, or those of the same kin release scents, you're attracting pollinators that are beneficial to your kin. But when you're surrounded by other plants, you may also want to reduce those scents to deprive the competitor from taking away those vital pollinators.
Well, it's a jungle out there.
It is. It is, yeah.
It's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but in reality, it's not. If you think it's not all that different from humans. Plants communicate. That's basic, and I think it was, if I'm not incorrect, Jack Schultz, a researcher, who said plants are like animals, just very slow.
Like very slow animals.
Just very slow.
Yeah.
So it's not different that you know, like think of animals. This is not unfamiliar to us, right? They forage for food. They protect their kin. They communicate with members of the same species. They may cooperate or not with members of different species. And plants are doing just exactly the same things. Just that their means of communicating, foraging, or acting upon those environmental factors are slightly different from those of animals because they lack what is a nervous system or an equivalent to a nervous system. And that's what we more closely associate with behavior in animals.
Beyond arguing against having invasive species too close to Manuka, for example, mm-hmm. lest you inhibit the bees and reduce the honey. What are the other applications of your research?
Well, there is a very interesting application of the research, and it pertains again to invasive species. I'm going to give you examples from the Central Plateau, like, for example, heather, or very common, very widespread invasive species. It was brought by early settlers and now occupies about 50,000 hectares of the park, of that area. And there have been many efforts to introduce biocontrol agents. So they just bring insects that interact with the plant in the native range and bring them to New Zealand in the hopes that they will chew or attack the plant and control it. But what they found out in many cases, and not only with this plant but with others, is that importing biocontrol agents is not always successful. One of the reasons we speculate why is because the plants behave differently in their native range than in their introduced ranges. So we're also trying to investigate and understand how that plant that is growing there in the Central Plateau of New Zealand is behaving differently than that plant up there in Scotland, and whether those chemical changes are going to make it more resistant to that herbivore.
I mean, it's kind of logical that the plant would behave differently.
It does.
In a completely different environment, different soil, structure, content, everything.
It does, but unfortunately that's not something that's quite often very well investigated.
I mean, that's the reason presumably why gorse, which is relatively under control in its native land, is an invasive weed here.
Exactly. First, because they escape their natural herbivores, but even if you were to bring those natural herbivores, they wouldn't be. The plant itself is behaving chemically probably in such a different manner
right.
that they're no longer compatible. They're no longer talking to each other.
So if you can find out what the difference in the heather here from the heather there is, then what?
Then you can, I think, first place, you could really inform those biocontrol decisions. One could try to identify those factors that create difference in the chemistry and inform and saying, okay, is this biocontrol agent going to work, yes or no? Because importing a biocontrol agent is a very expensive and strenuous procedure.
And risky,
because you're introducing something that doesn't belong there, and there's always the associated risk that it itself will become a pest or feed on other non-target species. So I think what we want to do is just be able to inform very early on and trying to make those tests, probably not in New Zealand, but already in the native range, where you expose the plant to similar circumstances that it's facing here and say, okay, is the herbivore going to eat the plant? Is it going to react well to it? Or is it not going to even touch it? Is this plant so different from it?
So what's been the experience hitherto? The introduced herbivores have not taken to the heather as hoped.
So the heather beetle was introduced to the Central Plateau in 1996. It has established, but only very patchily. And the reality is that apparently, from what we know from the last 4 years of research, we know that those plants, we've done some research in Scotland and also here in New Zealand, and we know that those plants here in New Zealand are very chemically active. And one of the main reasons why is because they are very exposed to UV radiation. That's very different from Scotland,
right.
Our levels of radiation. And UV is a stressor. And again, similar what happens with herbivores, when a plant is under a lot of stress, it's going to smell a lot. It's going to produce chemicals to protect itself. So the plants are really very different chemically. And we think that those volatiles of heather are, in fact, deterrent or make the plant unattractive.
Do you think that could be the explanation behind a lot of the invasive species? They're exposed to intense sunlight in New Zealand, and they produce a lot of volatiles because they're under stress.
And also chemicals as well.
And that deters the predators.
It may, exactly.
So but you'd think if they were under stress, they wouldn't thrive.
Well, Stress is an interesting concept when we talk about plants, right? Because, of course, there are levels of stress.
Obviously, good stress and bad stress.
Exactly. So plants can respond to certain level of stress, and obviously they will release these volatiles. Volatiles are very interesting because they also act like sunblock, because they form a thin layer of aerosols around the plant. So actually, they're very good at protecting the plant from radiation, you see? So the plant will be able actually effectively to thrive and protect itself by emitting those compounds. But if there was a stress that is very intense, you know, if you were really to put the plant underneath a continuous intense radiation, it would eventually die.
Right.
But at certain levels, the plant is able to cope with it. And actually, those volatiles are its coping mechanisms, to call them in a certain way.
So what you're doing really is fine-tuning an analysis of what grows in New Zealand because of the specific circumstances that plants are exposed to here.
Exactly. So what I'm trying to understand is I'm going trying to investigate invasive plants in their native range. Mm. And in this particular invasive range, that's very unique. And I'm trying to understand what are those factors of that are unique to New Zealand, let's call it UV radiation, that cause very intense or dramatic changes in the plant chemistry and how those changes affect the native species that live in those environments together with those invasives.
Have you had, you know, I always ask scientists this, have you had a eureka moment, a revelatory moment where you've had a breakthrough?
Oh, I've had quite a few of those throughout my career, but I think that this discovery when we realized that all of the invasives are this pattern that I'm telling you about the natives being quiet is one that we've observed with many species, not with only one. So we've observed it with heather and manuka. We know also that similar things occur for scotch broom. And we think that gorse also does the same thing. So actually, when we just started with this huge pile of data, analyzing it, and we just found that pattern, and we said, okay, it's not just this one plant.
Right.
It's a pattern. Mm. And I think that's a moment where you say, wow, that's amazing. And that's a eureka moment where you say, there's something happening. Typically, people think only about the competition and the most obvious thing, the biomass. But when you really are able to say, they're really disrupting communication. How amazing is that?
Mm.
And then, yeah, I think that was a very interesting moment where we said, okay, something's going on there.
That's what an ecosystem is, right? It's a system of communication.
It is, exactly. Yeah, it's a social network. I mean, plants and animals were very good at it.
So you've got the Marsden funding. What are you going to do with it?
Well, we were very lucky because I was telling you the story about this native plants going very quiet. And how plants change in their native and their invasive ranges. So the project that we're going to fund with the Marsden is called Plant Communication in Times of Rapid Environmental Change. And what we're going to explore is continue on exploring and trying to understand the reasons why. Not only the phenomenon itself, but to dig a little bit, and that can be very literal because we may be looking at the soil, so digging into the reasons why that communication may be changing and trying to see about a little bit more about the very practical implications that change in communication has, especially for our native plants and insects.
It's hard, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing to observe that something happens. Trying to work out why it happens could take quite a while.
It can, yes. I think we're in a good path, though.
I'm talking to Dr. Andrea Clavijo-McCormick. She's an entomologist studying chemical communication among organisms. You've also done a lot of research, as I understand, into stick insects. Is that right?
I've done some. Yeah, that's on the side.
On the side.
But I'm going to tell you about it.
I'd like to hear about it. Yeah. I did not know that stick insects could either be sexual or asexual.
Yes, that's true.
That's what I'm interested in, of course.
So many insects are parthenogenetic. That's how we call it in science, and that means that they have females that can reproduce without a male insemination. So that's true for stick insects. In New Zealand, there's a very interesting pattern because in the North Island, in some parts of the North Island, we have stick insect populations that are, most are female only reproduced.
So they only have clones?
Yes, that's correct. Where in other areas, we have populations that have both male and female stick insects.
Right.
So that's very interesting because imagine how exciting it is to see a species that has two different reproductive strategies.
Yes.
Within the same species.
Why do they have two reproductive strategies?
Well, we're trying to understand that better.
There is no advantage in an evolutionary sense to cloning.
Cloning can be advantageous when the environment is predictable and has lots of resources, because it's quite
easy. Takes the risk factor out.
Exactly. It's quite easy. You can reproduce anytime, anywhere, without going through the hurdle or the effort of finding a partner and all that comes with it. But when the environment turns very unpredictable, or resources are scarce, or in many cases, there is an advantage to having that genetic diversity, and that's what sexual reproduction brings with it, you know? You are creating genetic diversity that maybe is going to give the offspring advantages later on, because they're going to be more diverse. As whereas when you have a clone, you could imagine that all of the clonal organisms, they are going to be susceptible to the same diseases, after all, the same genes.
Right.
So there's this trade-off between the advantages of sexual versus asexual reproduction.
And so the stick insect is sexual in the north of the North Island and asexual in around Wellington?
Yes, that's correct.
Because it's more predictable around about Wellington?
Well, this is a question that pertains to the research of one of my colleagues, I guess, more than mine. But obviously, it has to do with the evolution of the species throughout the time. And apparently, apparently the Manawatu Gorge was the original or the initial division between the islands. So that created that sort of geographical isolation, and the species sort of diverged, and each of those separated groups took over time, adopted a completely different reproductive mode.
But asexual females can mate with males.
Well, that's something that we've been trying to tackle in our research. So it appears that if they are giving the option, I mean, if you offer a male an asexual female, they may try to mate them. So it's not that they've lost completely the ability to mate.
Right.
They just don't. They just don't, yeah.
And can you tell, or could one tell, by looking at a stick insect, whether it is asexual or sexual?
No, not by just...
Do you think stick insects can tell?
I think they do, and that's exactly what we were investigating. So we were investigating the stick insect scents to see if we could tell apart, based on their scent only, those sexual and asexual females.
Mm.
And actually what we found is quite interesting, because evolution is a process, you know, it's an ongoing thing. So what it looks like, there are, at the moment, they're starting to diverge in a particular group of compounds called monoterpenes. So you see that that one of the populations does have a little bit of a higher increase. So we think that they are starting to diverge in their sense. So I'm quite convinced that probably a male could tell, because insects do use scents to find their partner, especially a stick insect, right? They're very inconspicuous. They try to hide. So they would probably not choose visual cues as much as they would use scents to find their partners.
Right. And so the sexual and the asexual females would smell
differently. Indeed. Mm. And it kind of makes sense, because if females live in a population where there are no males in general, or there's few males, it takes energy, you know. I mean, it takes nutrients and energy to produce a scent that's going to be attracted to the males.
Yes.
So, of course, if you normally don't encounter lots of males, it's a waste of resources to invest in being very attractive in terms of smell.
Yeah.
But it makes sense for a sexual female to release those scents, because they're probably competing with other females, and they need to make themselves more attractive to potential partners.
This is probably beyond your field, but I never know, and I know that everything is wonderful and there is a place for it all, even mosquitoes, but are stick insects good to have in the garden, do you think? Or are they going to eat my plants?
That's a good question. It depends on which plants you have in your garden.
That's right, and what volatiles they're releasing.
And what volatiles they're releasing, that's correct. It's a tricky gardening question. I think that there are obviously always beneficial insects and some that are harmful, but I guess it depends mostly on, I mean, we do create circumstance. Insects are not good or bad. I mean, they just eat some plants or don't, and it depends on what you have on your garden.
That's what I mean. Nothing is good or bad. Yeah. They just, you know, it's all God's work. Just thinking about your volatiles and your plants for a moment. If you've got a herbivore munching a plant and the plant releases a volatile that attracts an enemy of the herbivore, is there any suggestion that different herbivores would evoke a different response from the plant?
There is.
No.
It is. And that's quite one of the most amazing things, because people, I dwell with insects a lot. So insects do have saliva. And when they are chewing on the plants, they also spit or release some or leave some spit on the plant.
Yeah.
And the plants are able to recognize some of the triggers or substances in that spit and then release volatiles that are different according to the herbivore that's damaging it.
Really?
And then there's a second part to it, which is also very interesting, is that, of course, damage can take different forms, right? So obviously an insect, a small baby larva is going to make little holes on the leaves, whereas a huge larva is going to take big chunks. So obviously the plants are very responsive to the amounts of damage as well. So they can actually even predict the density of their predator. You know, if they have lots of small chews in different parts of the plant, they know, okay, we're being attacked by plenty. And they are very responsive, and their volatiles are as well. So they can tell who's the attacker and how many attackers.
And so the herbivore's enemies somewhere out there can determine whether it's worth their while to make a trip.
Or not.
How weird is that? Do you know anything about Kawa Kawa?
Yes, a little bit. Yeah, I'm getting more and more familiar with the native species here.
I've always been led to believe that Kawa Kawa, there is a caterpillar that eats Kawa Kawa, and after a certain amount of eating, the Kawa Kawa is able to release some kind of toxin that the caterpillar doesn't like and goes away.
It does. Kawa Kawa does, but many other plants do, and I'm going to give you examples of things that of similar scenarios. We all know tobacco plants, right? Mm. People use nicotine and other substances, but nicotine is in the plant because it's there to deter herbivores. That's the real reason why the nicotine is in the tobacco plant. Plenty of research done in the United States in the Utah Desert has shown that these tobacco plants actually increase their amounts of nicotine depending on the levels of attack and the types of attacker. So it's quite common for plants to actually condensate these very toxic compounds. They normally don't have any. Again, it's expensive, right? So why would you produce a lot of it if you're not being attacked? Mm. So plants are very responsive to damage, and that's where they started triggering all their metabolic pathways to produce compounds that are toxic to the herbivore. Same or similar cases with the things that we like to eat, you know, wasabi or mustard. Those things are there because they're meant to be defenses.
Yes. So they're essentially toxins that we value.
Yes. Caffeine. you name it.
Caffeine.
Yeah, that's, I think, our favorite toxin. We like it, but imagine if you, I mean, many people, I personally get a rush from a cup of coffee. But now imagine if you're a tiny, tiny caterpillar, a very concentrated amount of caffeine is deadly, is toxic to them.
And that's why caffeine exists.
Exactly.
So, do you think?
Most of those things appear. Plants are very amazing in the wide variety of chemical compounds they can produce. And many of the most amazing ones, and especially those, many of those that we find unique or a very particular taste associated to it, are just defense compounds. They evolved because they are meant to be toxic or heavily deterrent to herbivores.
And that was the eco-chemical investigator, Dr. Andrea Clavio McCormick, talking about plant communication.